Well, this hour we'll take your phone calls with the Nobel Prize winner, Venki Ramakrishnan. His book, Gene Machine. You've heard what we've been talking about. Let's get your calls when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, where we will get to your calls with Venki Ramakrishnan, his book, Gene Machine. Venki, did life get here on a meteorite? How do you think it got here?
Well, there are people, you know, even Francis Crick suggested that maybe life got here on a meteorite. But the reality is, life is about half as old as what we think of as the universe or of the Earth. And so, you know, we wouldn't buy that much time by assuming that it came here on a meteorite. Because if it came here on a meteorite, you'd have to ask, well, where did it start? I mean, how did it get on a meteorite?
How did it get there? That's right.
Yeah, so it means it started somewhere else a little bit earlier. But you wouldn't buy that much time, because life is a few billion years old, and the universe is maybe, you know, 12 billion or something. So it's not like you would buy, you know, hundreds, you know, a factor of 100 in time for life to have evolved. So most people don't buy that. They think that what happened is life is, you can think of life as an assembly that can replicate itself. And people feel that it must have started many times. Most of the time it just fizzled out. And at one point, you know, somewhere it just took off and kept going. And that's what, you know, resulted in life today. And there might have been other forms that died out eventually, maybe fizzled out right away, and only one form survived, and that's what, you know, resulted in this enormous variety of life. And one reason to think that is that, you know, all the building blocks of life are the same in all organisms, from bacteria and viruses all the way to humans and to plants. And another is that the genetic code, you know, the code that specifies instructions in the DNA is very much, it's almost essentially identical in all species. So this suggests that, you know, life had a common origin, but probably originated on Earth.
Would you say that your field is very competitive? I mean, are the Russians involved in this? Are the Chinese involved in this?
The Russians were not so competitive for a very political reason, and that is, during Stalin's time, there was a guy named Lysenko who didn't believe in genetics because it was against, you know, what he thought of as communist philosophy. Because, you know, if you believe that, you know, genes are important, it means, you know, if you have good genes, you have an advantage, you're somehow, you know, more smarter or more talented or stuff like that. And the communists didn't like that. They wanted everybody to be essentially the same, right? So he didn't like genetics. And so under Stalin's Russia, genetics was, you know, essentially not considered science and was banned almost. You know, people were punished for doing that. So that held Russian biology back a lot. But it's of course, it's recovered now. But then Russia is not in the greatest shape,
right,
you know, economically.
How about the Chinese, Vin?
The Chinese are amazing. And, you know, 40 years ago, China was, you know, really nowhere on the sort of horizon, right? I mean, and actually about 50 years ago, it was even poorer than India. But the Chinese, since Deng Xiaoping, have invested so much in education, infrastructure, in facilities, and so on, that they've made a dramatic recovery. Now, one thing we in the West forget is that except for the last 200 or 300 years, China was top dog in most of history, okay, in terms of economics and advancement and, you know, knowledge, etc. It's only since the Enlightenment in Europe and the Industrial Revolution and the flourishing of knowledge that Europe and then the U.S., you know, really took off and became, you know, really, you know, the place where things were happening. And so now China is recovering. And I first went to China in 2011, and I thought it would be like India, but a little bit better. But actually, it was in a different league. It was almost, you know, as good as many parts of the West.
That's right.
And I thought the science was okay. It was pretty good, but not, you know, really terrific. Then I went back 5 years later, and I found in the best places, they're doing as good work as, you know, some of the best places in the West.
Well, as cells replicate, so do the Chinese with information and knowledge.
Exactly, you know, and they have, you know, made it a point. You know, they one of them told me that when Deng Xiaoping opened up China and allowed Chinese to go elsewhere, a lot of people said, no, you shouldn't do that, because if they go off to the U.S. or Europe or Britain or somewhere, they will never come back. And he said, no, what will happen is, out of every 10 people who go, only one will come back. But that's worth it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, and even of the other nine, some of them will come back to visit, you know, there'll be a little exchange of knowledge, it'll help us. And he was right, you know? And so what's happened is they've essentially vacuumed up knowledge, you know, from the West, and they've now are using it, you know, to improve China. So you can't blame them. I mean, America did the same thing in the 1800s. You know, Europe was the center of advancement and knowledge and technology, and America just, you know, basically sucked up know-how and then started using it. You know,
good point.
So all countries do that at a stage of development.
Let's go to the phones now, east of the Rockies, James in Beaumont, Texas. Hi, James.
Yes, before I ask my question, I wanted them to just touch on GMO foods' effects on genes and, you know, maybe gluten. I know glyphosate is already bad, but GMO and on genes, you know, the effects. And I wanted to ask a few questions after.
Okay, genetically modified foods. Any effect, do you think, Venki?
I think that what you have to realize is that you need to regulate the trait. The idea that, you know, GMO is some new, you know, Frankenstein food thing is not something that knowledgeable scientists buy, because what we're doing is we're very specifically changing something that happens in nature anyway. So if you look at all our foods, wheat or corn or something, and you compare it to their ancestors, this is just almost unrecognizable. But these are the results of centuries of genetic changes that we selected for by breeding, okay, in a random way. We didn't know which genes were changing, but we kept selecting crops that we liked. But now we know more about genetics. We can say, if we change this gene, then we can, you know, the crop might have a drought tolerance, or it might have better nutrition, or it might be, you know, shorter and have a bigger yield, or it might be insect resistant. So these are all things we can control about. I think what a lot of people don't like is that a lot of the genetic modified crops are produced by big multinational companies.
Yes.
And they don't trust them, okay, because they're there to make a profit, and they don't trust them. But I think what we need to do is regulate genetic modified crops, make sure they're safe.
Oh, absolutely.
The procedure is not the problem. And I can give you an example. You know, natural does not mean good. If I eat a poisonous mushroom, it's perfectly natural, but I'll be dead, you know, in 24 hours,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So natural and artificial are not the problem. The problem is, what is the trait you want to introduce? And if you want to introduce a trait that provides better nutrition, better drought tolerance, better yield, etc., that's fine. I don't think that's going to be a real problem.
Let's go back for your other question, James. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, when he said about, you know, breeding, you know, the crops to produce pesticides, they can have a harm on your intestinal flora. But I wanted to move on to something else. I read that, you know, there's widespread zinc deficiencies, you know, worldwide. And I also read before that it's responsible for the transcription and translation of DNA. Is there any noticeable effects because of that deficiency?
No, a lot of our proteins contain zinc, and you're quite right. Many of them are involved in what are called transcriptional factors. These are proteins that turn on and turn off genes. And so we do need zinc in our food, but the amount of zinc we need is tiny. So if we eat a normal diet, we get plenty of zinc. If we, you know, there's plenty of zinc even in tap water, in most tap water. So, you know, I don't think that the average person needs to take zinc supplements.
All right, next up, let's go to Mary in New Jersey. Hi, Mary, go ahead.
Hello, my question's similar about food, diet. If humankind started out as a vegetarian and they added meat to their diet, just about your diet, how much can it change the structure of a human?
All right. Will your food diet, if you change it dramatically, change your cell structure, Venki?
No. So you have to think about what happens when we eat food. When we eat food, we break it down into its building blocks. So if we eat protein, like in meat, as I mentioned, proteins are long chains of amino acids. So what our stomachs and intestines do is they break that chain out up into the individual building blocks. Those building blocks go through our intestine into our blood and into all our cells. And then our cells put together those building blocks to make our own proteins, okay? So it almost doesn't matter what you eat as long as you get enough of the building blocks that you need. So you need a certain amount of protein, you need a certain number of amount of sugar, of, you know, zinc, as the previous caller pointed out. So you need all of these ingredients, and then our body puts together what makes us from those building blocks. And so a lot of nutrition has to do with deficiency. If you don't get enough protein, then, you know, you get a disease. If you don't get enough carbohydrate, you know, you'll lack energy, you'll start starving. So many of those things are deficiency problems. But those of us in the West, our problem is not getting enough. It's getting too much. You know, we're more worried about obesity and,
sure,
you know, and those sort of. So my advice to most people is eat a good balanced diet. Don't eat too much. Eat a diet that has enough protein, a little bit of carbohydrate. You also need some fat, although the body can make fat from sugar, so it's not as big an issue. And eat lots of fresh fruits and vegetables because they have vitamins and all of the you know, minerals and things like zinc that the caller mentioned. So if you eat a nice balanced diet, that's probably the best thing you can do. And I think a problem is many people's lives are so hectic that they're not thinking about that balanced diet. They're, you know, they're buying some, you know, microwave meal and just, you know, sticking it in. And that's the a real problem.
Tom in the Bronx. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Good, Tom.
I'd like to say this, that cancer, there's a doctor in New York that made a claim cancer is actually funguses. Is that true?
Cancer is, sorry, what?
A fungus.
Cancer can be funguses.
No, cancer is the result of DNA damage in the cell. Now, the DNA damage could be caused by a lot of different it could have a lot of different causes. It could be caused by chemicals. It could be caused by exposure to radiation. It could be caused by viruses in some cases. But fundamentally, it's about damage to our own genes. That's what happens.
Venki, where do people get your book, The Gene Machine?
Oh, they can buy it. It's available on Amazon. It's available in bookstores. Hopefully, Barnes & Noble is going to have it. So, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, it shouldn't be too hard to buy.
And you're married
it's really
to a...
It's meant for a very general reader. There's quite a bit of science in it, but it's meant to give people not only about the ribosome and so on, but also about what scientists are like. What is it like to be an outsider in the middle of this, you know, pitched race for this machine, the whole thing about the politics of prizes, competition, egos. So it's really a story, you know, so it's meant to be read like a novel.
With the trials and tribulations of a scientist.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Super. And you're married to a pretty prolific children's books writer, aren't you?
That is right. She's published about 30 books and a whole series called the Vera series, which is based on her childhood in Ohio. She grew up in a town just west of Cleveland. So it's really, I think a lot of Americans, and actually children all over the world, will relate to it because they're about very common first experiences, like your first visit to a dentist or the first mm-hmm. time you're really sick or your first day of school, things like that.
Janet Brooklyn,
New York.
Those
are available, too. I mean, her last name is Rosenberry, Vera Rosenberry. But, you know, if you just Google Vera books, you know,
they pop up.
Find it.
Yeah, they're cute books, too. Jan, let's get your question in. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
A comment and a question. GMOs, I find the food tastes terrible, and the energy, it weakens me. I think they're absolutely horrible, everything I've ever seen.
All right, let's get your question in real fast.
The genes, are there certain, have you found where genes for the immune system, why people are weakened or the viruses, do you have a connection with the genes for that?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question. Could you...
Well, with your genes, is there anything that distinguishes, you know, one's ability to fight viruses and things like that genetically?
Well, not on the whole. I think some people just have a stronger immune system that allows them to maybe ward off infections better. It is true that some people have a weakened immune system for genetic reasons and are more susceptible to infections. So there is variation. But on the whole, humans are very good at fighting off, you know, we're constantly being infected by bacteria and viruses, and we're not all sick all the time, and it's because our immune system is working and is fighting off these infections.
I'm not a fan of antibiotics, Ben Key. I think we've overused them.
Oh, incredibly. And one of the worst uses, I should tell you, is in agriculture, because people found out almost by accident that if you give antibiotics to, you know, cows and pigs and so on, they fatten them up. And ever since then, there's been this tendency to feed cattle antibiotics to fatten them up. And that is not only bad for the, you know, animal, and, you know, I wouldn't really...
It's bad for us when they pass it through.
It's probably bad for us, but it's also causing resistance.
Well, that's a good point. Thank you for the book, Gene Machine. Keep in touch with us. It's great always talking to a Nobel Prize winner. Up next, The Great Debate. We called it Two Go In, One Comes Out, The Great Debate between ufologist Stanton Friedman and the skeptic Michael Shermer. Well, tonight, the skeptic's cage, Two Go In, One Comes Out. Who will it be, Stanton Friedman, the ufologist, or Dr. Michael Shermer, the skeptic? Okay, two guests for you. Stanton Friedman, he received his B.S. and M.S. degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 56, where Carl Sagan was a classmate. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, TRW, Aerojet, General Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas on such advanced, highly classified, eventually canceled projects such as nuclear aircraft fission and fusion rockets. Since 1967, he has lectured on the topic of UFOs. He's been all over the country, all over the world. Stanton Friedman was with me and Michael Shermer on the Larry King Show a few weeks ago. Hey, Stanton, how are you?
Well, it's a good morning here. I figured out some puzzles. I'm happy.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And Dr. Michael Shermer, of course, is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's the director of the Skeptic Society, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of the Skeptic's Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology. He also edits Skeptic.com. Dr. Shermer received his BA degree in psychology from Pepperdine University, his MA in experimental psychology from California State University, and his PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He, too, is with us on Coast to Coast. Hello, Michael. Welcome
back. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good to have you both with us. Of course, when we were on the Larry King Show, Stanton and Michael were in the corner swinging at each other. I had to break it up. Only kidding, guys. Only kidding.
Throwing chairs.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Michael, how did you have a good time on the King Show? What'd you think?
Oh, those shows are always frustrating because they're fairly short and everybody talks over one another. I found one of the most amusing things was emails I got days afterwards from fellow skeptics who said, the other guys kept talking over you. How come you weren't more aggressive? And then from UFO people that said, how come you kept interrupting the UFO people? You were so rude.
And too aggressive.
So we all filter these things through our own biases, I think.
Stanton, how about you? What kind of a time did you have on the King Show?
Well, it was a frustrating is a good word for it. Too many people, no chance to finish thoughts. I got asked why the cover-up. I said there are six reasons in the article on my website, and I gave one, and suddenly we were someplace else. That was frustrating, and, you know, it's not a good way to get at truth when you got so many people talking so quickly on such a diverse collection of topics. You know, I admire Buzz Aldrin, but I didn't think a lesson on how the rocket works was, very useful.
And that was going to go on and on and on, too.
Yes.
Well, tonight what we'll do is we'll have a friendly discussion on why, Stanton, you believe in the existence of UFOs, and you, Michael, why you believe that we don't. But you look at things as, are you a debunker or a skeptic? There's a big difference, Michael.
Yeah, big difference. Skepticism is just a tool. It's not a thing. It's not a position you take. I don't think of it as a noun. I think of it more as a verb, that it's just a way of analyzing claims. You can be skeptical of a claim. You can be skeptical of the skeptics. Global warming certainly comes to mind. There are people that are skeptical of global warming, and there are people that are skeptical of the so-called global warming skeptics. And that's a nice example, I think, of a current event that shows it really is just a way of analyzing claims, and people can differ on how they use the tool. So in the case of UFOs and SETI and so forth, it isn't a position to take. There's, several different questions to ask. Are they out there? Have they come here? What is the quality of the evidence for each of the different kinds of claims? And you have to take them one at a time, and it would be obviously dogmatically closed-minded to just say, well, I just don't believe, period. You don't believe what? I mean, you have to take them one claim at a time. And that's what we try to do at Skeptic with all the different things, like alternative medicine. I mean, there's thousands of claims. You can't just say, I don't believe any of them. You have to, look at each one of them.
Well, we've got a lot of time on this program, unlike Larry had. So let us start with you, Stanton, and I'll just give you a moment of opening remarks on why you're a believer.
Well, I'm not a believer. I'm a scientist who's been looking at the data for 49 years, been lecturing about it for 40 years, which gives me plenty of feedback. It's overall evidence that Michael never deals with, and I actually figured out tonight why he makes extraordinary claims, like that there's that only anecdotal evidence, for example, or no security aspect of this, and I figured all that out. Basically, I've reached four major conclusions. One, the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. In other words, some underlined 37 times, some UFOs are alien spacecraft, most are not. Don't care about them. Secondly, that we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate, meaning some few people within the major governments of the planet have known since at least 1947, when two craft were recovered in southeastern New Mexico, alien craft and alien bodies, that indeed some UFOs are alien spacecraft. The third conclusion is that there are no good arguments against flying saucer reality against the first two conclusions, only people who haven't looked at the evidence, such as Michael. And fourth, we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. Not two millennia, one millennia. Visits to planet Earth by alien spacecraft, successful cover-up of the best data bodies and wreckage for 60 years. That's quite remarkable. So that, in a nutshell, is where I stand. And in my lectures, of course, I go through evidence. Now, we don't have time for me to present a bunch of slides. Even if I hold them close to the telephone, you won't see them. So we'll deal with evidence as we go along and my solution to why Michael makes extraordinary claims, and we'll get on with
it. All right. All right. And Michael, why are you the skeptic?
Well, again, I separate the two major questions. Are extraterrestrial intelligences out there somewhere in the cosmos, and have they come here? And obviously the answer to the first question is nobody knows. We have to keep looking, listening, searching, sending out spacecraft, using radio telescopes and so on, like the SETI program does. And like most of the SETI scientists, I would say, you know, it would be remarkable if we were alone. I mean, as Carl Sagan liked to say, you know, what a considerable waste of space, and it would be rather egocentric and narrow-minded of us to think that we're special, we're alone. You know, the Copernican principle here applies, that we're not special, that if it happened here, it likely happened elsewhere. The raw numbers by themselves, the, you know, 100 billion galaxies, you know, 100 billion stars in each one of them, and let's say only 10%, but probably more, have planets, mm-hmm. You just end up with a probability of close to one that there has to be extraterrestrial intelligence somewhere out there. And I'm not talking just about bacterial-grade life, but actual intelligence.
So you believe that?
Yeah, believe it. Okay, that's a word.
That's my favorite word.
I think it's highly probable, although we have no evidence of it yet, so we have to just keep looking.
But you don't believe it's here.
I'm here. No, I think there's a lot of good arguments against the idea that they've come here, and if they have, they wouldn't resemble anything like what you typically see in the narratives of alien abduction experiences and those sorts of things, where there are bipedal primates that are bilaterally symmetrical with two arms and two legs and a head and two eyes and so forth. That, I mean, that only happened once in the, you know, 4 billion year history of Earth and of the trillions of species that have evolved and gone extinct. Only one lineage has become bipedal primates, us. And so the idea that that happened somewhere else is pretty improbable, and that they then happen to find us in the, you know, vast emptiness of the cosmos, that makes it seem even more unlikely. And therefore, the terrestrial hypothesis that people are having psychological experiences, sleep disorders, hallucinations, illusions, their creative, fantasy-prone personalities, whatever, concocting stories of aliens that look like us, that seems more probable than the previous scenario.
Last hour of the program, when we go to phone calls, so we would have had 2 hours of this debate. I'll open up the fast blasts, and we'll have listeners vote without trying to skew anything. We'll just take them as they come in on who they felt won tonight's Skeptics Cage debate. I remember, Stanton, when you did the first one with Seth Shostak, you won, did you not?
Well, it was 57-33-10. I didn't get a prize, though, George.
No, the prize has not come yet. The prize actually will be doing a full show with you on your Betty Hill book.
Okay.
How about that?
I can put up with that as a prize. I mean, I've read the book. I don't think Michael read the book.
I don't know.
No,
if you had it with you, right?
Betty Hill book.
Well, I'm going to break down tonight's debate in different areas and concepts. And Michael, you basically have started the first one for us, and that is, there's no question that this universe has billions of planets in there, and that the possibility of life out there is pretty strong. Let's address that first and foremost, not whether we've been visited or not, but life out there. Stanton, of course, being the scientist who believes in visitation, obviously then you're the believer in life out there elsewhere. But I want you to elaborate, as a scientist, why you believe there are many planets out there inhabited by intelligent beings.
Well, you know, I can't come to a conclusion as to how many are inhabited by intelligent beings. Unlike Michael, I don't think it's probable or improbable. When you don't have data, you might as well throw darts at a dartboard. The simple fact of the matter is there are bipedal beings coming here. Now, how many planets out there have life? We don't know. We do have to take into account, though, that the distribution of life, even on our planet, is related to things like colonization and migration. So if it starts at one place, it could move on all over the place. And we don't know. It's like SETI. You know that I've said that SETI is like silly effort to investigate, because when you look at the Drake equation, there's no way to put in numbers. We don't know what fraction of planets develop life. We don't know what fraction of those develop intelligence, or what fraction of those send signals. It's not an equation. There's no way to put numbers in it. The estimates vary from a few thousand to a few billion. That tells you it isn't a description of Mother Nature or of the world around us. It's dartboard physics. As a scientist, I believe in dealing with the real-world physics. And so, you know, life out there, sure, it's coming here. I don't know where. I have some ideas where some of it might come from, but we cannot make statements about the distribution of life out there because nobody's given us a map. Yeah, there are a bunch of civilizations over in this corner and a bunch over there. These guys have been fighting those guys. These guys have settled up over here. We don't know. That's look. I'm a scientist, not a writer. Michael's a good writer. He's a good stand-up comedian. I watch some of his stuff on YouTube. But that's different from science. You have to say you don't know. I have a huge gray basket. I know that the evidence is that there are critters, if you will, coming here in manufactured craft. That doesn't mean I know why, who, how. I mean, I try to deal with these questions on my website and elsewhere. But we cannot make any statements about how common or how rare, because we haven't picked up a signal. Using our equipment, we presume that aliens are stuck at our level of technology. I find that an extraordinary claim. What basis do we have? And we know how quickly our technology has evolved. Look at the past 110 years or so. You know, flight and radio and microwaves and DNA and a whole slew of things in a lousy 100 years. So what if somebody got started a little bit before we did, you know, say 10,000 years?
Michael, your turn.
Well, the SETI program with the so-called Drake equation, you know, this is just the first approximation to get our minds around thinking about how best to try to make contact if there is some intelligence out there. So while it's true for some of the components of the equation, such as how many planets typically give life, you know, we have no idea. But some of the other parts of the equation are getting more refined. For example, the number of planets, the number of stars that have planets, the number of G-type stars like ours that have planets and so forth. I mean, we've discovered now over 250 extrasolar system planets. And so it's giving us a good approximation that at least 10% of every star in the galaxy has planets. And that's probably a conservative estimate. So we can thereby start to make slightly more refined probability guesses that, well, you know, probably the chances are even more that there's extraterrestrial life out there. That's, in, you know, sort of a plus for both SETI and, I suppose, the UFO community. And, you know, when they launch Kepler in a few years, and it'll be able to find planets around stars the size, or be able to find planets the size of Earth, not just Jupiter size. The only reason we find Jupiter-sized planets is because that's the level of sophistication of the technology. So, but what I just told you is not anything that any SETI scientist would tell you. I mean, Seth Shostak's been on your show.
Sure.
He would say everything I just said, and he would not make any claims about we know or we don't know. And I mean, what Seth and all the SETI scientists say is we have to look. We don't know. Nobody knows. And these are just first approximations. And I'm not sure why Stan is degrading or putting down the SETI program. I don't know what the purpose of that is. I mean, they're not making any particular claims. They're just looking.
Yes, they are making a particular claim. They're claiming that nobody's coming here, but if we want to find extraterrestrial intelligence, we got to look for a signal.
I don't think they make any claims about that unless you ask them. I mean, they've never published anything like, "We hereby declare we don't think people have come here."
But, I mean, they've said that, though, Michael.
If you ask them, I suppose they'd say, yeah, I doubt it, like something along
I would say.
But that's not part of the SETI program. The SETI program is just a scientific search. And whether they come here or not is not part of their paradigm. They're not looking for aliens here.
Why not? When there's evidence that there are aliens here, and we have no evidence, as you have said, and I've agreed, we really have no evidence about what's going on out there. All we can do is look at what's coming here. We don't
obviously stand. They don't
mean nobody's
agree
sending
with your evidence.
I'll agree with that too.
Obviously, they don't agree that there's evidence that they've come here. If they did,
you haven't looked at the evidence. That's one of the most remarkable aspects.
I completely disagree with you there, and. I would recommend to your listeners a terrific book on this subject called Roswell by Carl Flock, who I believe you've had on the show, George.
Mm-hmm.
He's a UFO believer now. He believes aliens have come here, are coming here. And this is an
hardly a UFO.
He completely debunks all of the Roswell stuff and really shows, I think, with great intellectual courage and honesty, how easy it is to filter out evidence that supports what you want to believe in.
Well, by the way, Stanton Friedman won that debate. For Dan Galante, Donna Walker, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.